Welcome to the My Ag Life Daily News Report. I'm Sabrina Halverson. We start with our news brief today on this Friday. Supply chain issues have made life more difficult for U.S. farmers, ranchers, and rural communities. Chad Smith has more on how these supply chain issues could make the holiday season more challenging for shoppers as well.
Ongoing supply chain challenges that have plagued the U.S. economy can be traced back to stay-at-home orders put in place at the start of the COVID-19 pandemic. Dr. Roger Cryan, chief economist with the American Farm Bureau Federation, says consumers clog supply lanes with purchases of goods rather than services.
They ended up buying a lot of stuff from across the Pacific Ocean, and that stuff clogged up the ships and the containers and the ports. All that overloaded supply chain infrastructure is getting in the way of things getting to the U.S., like machine parts and computer chips for tractor manufacturers and fertilizer for farmers. It's also causing some problems for farmers exporting as well.
Cryan says those issues will likely impact the holidays.
It's going to make it hard for a lot of folks who wanted to get stuff from across the ocean for Christmas, for holiday gifts and so forth. It's raising prices for some other things. We did a Thanksgiving survey that showed the price of the turkey is up. But I think the biggest issues are across the economy.
He says consumers can help ease some of the supply chain issues by shopping closer to home.
If you want to help unclog the supply chain, you could buy less stuff that has to come across the ocean and through our West Coast ports. And think about alternatives. Think about shifts in your holiday buying. We can buy a lot of different things for the holidays. Maybe buy a fruit basket from the farm stand or a cheese box or some local wine from your farmer's market. Gift certificate for the restaurant on Main Street. That's good for a lot of things. We want you to get that new TV you want, but maybe later. We believe trade is a good thing, and American farmers depend on trade. But this year, you could try looking for the things close by that can bring you joy this holiday season.
Chad Smith, Washington.
Several agricultural groups reacted to key provisions found in the Build Back Better Act. Growth Energy, the National Corn Growers Association, National Farmers Union, and the Renewable Fuels Association are grateful for the congressional efforts to build new markets for farmers and biofuel producers. In a letter to the chairs of the House and Senate Ag Committees, the group also say they appreciate the efforts to help lower the carbon intensity of agriculture. USDA researchers have made a discovery in bacteria associated with a major cattle disease that can perhaps be used in detection and intervention. Rod Bain has more.
Bovine respiratory disease covers quite a few ailments in cattle and can be caused by a variety of factors, from bacteria to genetics. But USDA molecular biologist Mike Clausen says no matter the cause, BRD is costly to treat.
The beef cattle industry loses up to an estimated $1 billion a year due to bovine respiratory disease. That's animal loss and treatment.
Complicated by current treatment regimens such as antibiotics and reactions such as antimicrobial resistance. Clausen and research colleagues discovered that outer membrane proteins of bacteria closely associated with BRD contain antigens, which can be used in future preventative measures that
specifically target the pathogenic bacteria and leave the other bacteria that are not pathogenic alone.
Examples include rapid tests to isolate infected cattle and prevent an outbreak, as well as more direct interventions like vaccines. I'm Rod Bain reporting for the U.S. Department of Agriculture in Washington, D.C.
A successful farming article says there may be trouble ahead for the upcoming farm bill in Washington, D.C. A former USDA official says the 2023 legislation could be in trouble if the political turbulence surrounding the last two farm bills keeps going into next year. The House defeated the normally bipartisan bill in 2013 and 2018 because of a partisan battle over reduced SNAP spending. The 2013 vote was the first time the farm bill had ever been defeated on the House floor. More potential backlash over the farm bill could include the $53 billion worth of trade war and coronavirus relief payments given to farmers since 2018, as well as the disparity in support between cotton and rice compared to corn, beans, and wheat. Food prices are continuing to increase this year, but will food price inflation cool down in 2022? Here's Gary Crawford.
We are continuing to see prices go up at the grocery store.
So far in 2021, food at home prices have increased on average 2.8%.
And Agriculture Department economist Carolyn Chelius says for the year they could be up by as much as 3.5%. Some products, of course, up a lot more than that. For example, so far this year,
beef and fuel prices have increased 7.6%. And we're predicting prices will increase 7.5% to 8.5%.
And if you compare beef prices now to 12 months ago, they are about 20% higher. Meanwhile,
pork prices have increased 7.2%, and we're predicting prices will increase 7 to 8%.
and they are 14% higher than 12 months ago. And Chania says, remarkably, of all the major food categories she follows,
no food category so far has seen a price decrease.
Oh, so is this going to continue in 2022?
It's really hard to know what factors are going to continue to play a part, what factors might abate.
Right now, she's got food prices going up about 2% next year. Gary Crawford for the U.S. Department of Agriculture.
That's our news for today. We will be right back.
Agromayor Nursery is the premier nursery in California. Whether it's almonds, walnuts, pistachios, prunes, or olives, Agromayora has been the grower's source for over 20 years and is the home of Rootpack R Almond, Grizzly Walnut, and the North American plants UCB1 and Platinum Clonal Pistachio Rootstocks. As the worldwide leader in super high-density almonds, olives, and prunes, Agromayora can show you how to cut costs and increase yields with their super high-density rootstock Rootpack 20. For more information or to schedule a site visit, contact a representative at 530-812-3398 today. Salty, closed soils can render your crops unproductive. DSAL, formulated by AgroPlanté, is specially designed for sodic and saline sodic soils. DSAL will displace sodium and wash it out of the root zone with irrigation to enhance your soil structure, water penetration, and vitality by decreasing soil salinity. AgroPlanté's DSAL flocculates your soil to promote soil aeration and drainage. With DSAL, you'll create a better soil environment for your crop roots and optimize yield. Contact AgroPlanté today to find out more at 559-498-0388 or visit us at agroplanté.com. The California Walnut Board and Commission provides value to the California walnut industry by working together with growers and handlers to advance the industry. Together, the California Walnut Board and Commission are helping to protect, develop, and grow California walnuts domestically and internationally. The California Walnut Board provides funding and strategic direction on walnut production and post-harvest research designed to help support the industry and promote California walnuts. To learn more, visit our website at walnuts.org. Together we grow.
Welcome back. One of the sessions at last week's National Association of Farm Broadcasting Convention was titled Expanding Processing Possibilities. It explored how the USDA could and should expand meat processing capabilities. Featured speakers were Scott Brown, the University of Missouri Director of Strategic Partnerships with the College of Ag, and Lee Reichmuth from the U.S. Cattlemen's Association Board of Directors. We have the audio for you now. It starts with session moderator DeLos Yonke of RFD Radio Network in Illinois.
So, gentlemen, thank you both for coming and participating in this. Lee, if I could start with you. And, you know, the topic of this is expanding processing possibilities. Some of this is probably still possibilities, but some of it may be developing even like more closer to reality than even processing.
Yeah, it was a big week, actually, announcement yesterday by American Food Groups in Missouri here. They're actually going to open up a new plant. It sounds more like a cow Holstein slaughter capacity, roughly around 450 million. That was announced. They've been working on that for a little while, but they're working on getting permits. There's also a plant being discussed up in the North Platte, Nebraska area. Word is that they're expected to be breaking ground before too long. There's also a announcement of a plant into southwest Iowa as well. So to add to the capacity.
So these things have been in the works. I mean, they won't happen overnight, but these kind of discussions have gone on for a long
time. No, it takes time. I need, it takes time for one to get financing lined up, which is a big thing. It's hundreds of millions of dollars, so it takes definitely a lot of financing behind it. There's also permits that need to go into place. There's economic developments, which my colleague on the right here can probably talk to you about a little bit more, but there's it takes a lot to open up a plant. It isn't something that happens overnight.
Right. Scott, if you wouldn't mind, just like a general overview of where we are in the marketplace and maybe what has led to some of this, the talk about expanding possibilities.
Yeah, for sure. So good afternoon, everyone. So I'll say, you know, just stay tuned. The cattle industry always changes over time. The things that we've been through the past 2 or 3 years might look a lot different in front of us. Sometimes I remind us that, you know, these plants that we're talking about today are real positive, but the AFG announcement yesterday, that I think at best is probably third quarter of 2024 before that plant is operational. So that's not going to fix our some of our issues that maybe we talk about in terms of not enough capacity here in the very near term. I'd like to start by reminding us all that it's been dry in many parts of cattle country, and I think that the changes as we get further into 2022 as a result of just fewer cattle are going to mean a very different situation. Packers generally have had the upper hand with ample cattle numbers. They don't have to bid very hard. Margins are very wide. That could change pretty rapidly when you just look at placement data that we've seen so far year to date, or at least January through September. About 17 million ahead of cattle that we've placed in feed yards. You look at that relative to our beginning feeder cattle supply outside of feed yards. We've been pulling cattle ahead. And we've done that for a couple, 3 years. We can't keep doing that. So I keep thinking numbers will tighten as we get further into 22 and into 2023. And so I think that changes then the pricing opportunities as we look ahead.
Hmm. Where would you, so north of Columbus, south of Norfolk, right?
Yep.
Where do you finish cattle?
We do. Yep.
Where do they go?
They go to various different plants. I don't go sell to one particular. It kind of depends on who has the highest bid. There's two in particular that we there's two that we mainly go to, but I distribute cattle to different packing plants.
How far away are they?
The one is 60 miles. The other one's around 100 miles. Yeah. But you know, I ship some cattle Monday that went down to Dodge City, Kansas. So. Okay.
I can remember the IBP guy would show up every once in a while and he'd quote a price, and I just remember thinking as a kid, I was like, that's not very good for the, I mean, that's not probably not helpful for the farmer when only one guy shows up and bids on those cattle. So because like what you're saying, not everybody has options like that.
Yeah, there's parts of the country that there may only be one or two packing companies in that certain geographic area that, you know, unfortunately that's the players that are in that marketplace.
Mm-hmm. What about Missouri? Where would if someone was feeding cattle in Missouri, do they have options like that or?
So not many nearby options in Missouri. We don't feed a lot of cattle in Missouri. There's one reason why we always say, you know, 80% of the feeder cattle we produce here actually are destined for Kansas, Nebraska, Iowa. We just don't feed that many cattle. Perhaps with a new plant coming on, that might give us an opportunity to feed some cattle. That's, again, primarily probably going to be a cow-kill plant. But I think the opportunity to expand into some fed cattle is certainly in the mix for AFG. I'll just say, you know, so thin markets can create challenges. Mm-hmm. We've certainly seen some of that. And at some points, even getting one buyer to come to look at those cattle has gotten a little tougher at times, especially with COVID-19 creating all the bottlenecks that it has. So we certainly have our challenges. I always say, as the economist, this is the balance between markets being too thin and taking advantage of economies of scale. Mm-hmm. Those large plants certainly have a leg up in terms of processing cattle.
Yeah, I want to open this for questions. Certainly, if you have any question, raise your hand or step toward the microphone, and certainly have plenty of time to get those in. Kyle, while you're heading over there.
Can I not just say it really loud? No, you can't hear me. Yeah.
You know, I used to, so you mentioned Dodge City, like that IBP guy doesn't show up anymore because IBP and Emporia is long gone. And so the bidder, so our cattle from Kansas would also go to Dodge City. So that really shows, you know, just how concentrated that would be. If you could say your name and your affiliation, please, and your question, that would be very helpful.
Kyle Bauer, Kansas, KFRM Radio.
You know, a lot of plants have excess capacity. They just can't get the labor to do it. Is that going to be addressed? Is there a way of addressing that? I mean, with this kind of margin, you would think that they could attract workers by just raising the wages. It appears not, or they would, or is it just better for them to kill less cattle and make more and not have to work as hard?
I mean, the packing... You have seen wages increase. A lot of them have gone up $3 to $5 an hour, roughly. I don't know if, you know, every plant and company is going to be different, but wages have increased. The problem is that the capacity between a Monday and Friday is about maxed out, and so those extra cattle that you need to get slaughtered is getting made up on Saturdays. And the problem is when you get your help to show up on Saturdays, they want 2-day weekends and then they're not showing up on Mondays. So they've raised wages. They've done various other things, as you know, providing, you know, healthcare, doctors on sites, doing things like that to entice people to work. But the fact of the matter is, it's a very labor intensive industry, and this country's honestly short of labor as it is today.
Yeah, I don't think we fix the labor issue very quickly. I go name the industry that isn't having a labor issue right now, and the cattle processing side is just one of several. And so I don't think just raising wages is going to fix that very quickly. I think it's something we live with for a while, and owning a plant that's not running all the time at 100% capacity, you lose some of the economies of scale that I just talked about earlier. So it's a fine balancing act for these folks in terms of running those plants. I don't think we fix this labor problem quickly at all. This isn't months to potentially take care of. We may be talking, you know, multiple years to get beyond that. Of course, we're going to look at other alternatives to labor at some point. What's it cost for more automation, which is tough in the cattle industry, just given the lack of uniformity of cattle going through. But you're eventually going to push more and more towards trying to figure out other ways besides labor. I think the point about getting them to show up after asking for a Saturday shift on the following Monday is an excellent example of how tough it is to keep folks engaged right now. Where you locate plants going forward relative to population will be an interesting discussion in my mind. Can you find better locations that will allow a big packing plant to come in and provide perhaps a bigger pool of labor to draw from? I think that's been part of the issue we've seen as well.
You remember in the mid to late 90s, especially in Missouri, I remember there were a lot of meetings about whether it was cooperative or not, but the forming of ethanol plants, building ethanol plants, and whether that was a farmer-owned cooperative or however that worked, there were a lot of meetings. Some were built, some didn't exactly make it. Are there lessons, whether it's ethanol or something else, are there lessons to be learned from previous ventures of, you know, how do we, whether that's vertically integrate our commodities or, you know, how we go into business one way or another?
I mean, U.S. Premium Beef Shares is somewhat set up as a co-op, and they've had a lot of success with it. It sounds like the North Platte plan is kind of destined for that similar model, but there has definitely been some failures along the way on several companies that have gone broke. The one in South Dakota, I can't think of, drawn blank, but you know it went bankrupt 3 times before where somebody took over. So that model seems to be discussed, especially like we said with the North Platte one.
Mm-hmm.
So I think your Missouri example for ethanol plants, I mean, think about who owns those ethanol plants today. In many cases, it's not the original farmers who maybe purchased shares. Those have already traded hands and owned by larger organizations. So I think there's continued discussion about better coordination How do you do that? And is a co-op model the way to potentially, you know, handle some of that? That discussion, I think, is ongoing. I still find a lot of cattlemen that are pretty independent and, frankly, probably aren't all that interested in that co-op model. I think you head down that co-op model road and you have to find consistency in the cattle that you want to put through that program. And I think that creates some struggles as, again, some producers like the independent style of being a cattleman.
Something like that requires some cooks in the kitchen, you know. So how do you take people who are fiercely and proudly independent and build something, and, you know, who runs it, who, you know, how does that sort of thing operate? So could be just growing pains, but could be real challenges, I would think.
Yeah, all these companies are going to have to figure that out, what's going to be best for their niche, their market share, because obviously they're going to have one in order to succeed going forward. So a lot of them you're seeing that are bringing in excellent management that have had some experience in the past to help with that transition. And so, yeah.
JCS Marketing is your number one way to connect with the ag industry. Through print magazines, digital media, podcasts, and live and virtual events, JCS Marketing has the reach to inform, educate, and influence growers in the Western United States.
Everywhere you go, you see West Coast Nut Magazine on every one of my customers' tables. So that tells you everything. It's there, so they're reading it.
Our My Ag Life platform includes podcast interviews and digital articles for busy professionals on the go. Our live events, continuing education webinars, and virtual conferences help growers connect with leading researchers and industry leaders. Let JCS Marketing help you connect.
Megan Grebner, Brownfield Ag News. So it's going to be a long question, so bear with me. We talk about increasing and incentivizing more packers, more competition. What happens when that competition maybe gets too thin? Does it just kick the can down? Do we run into this risk of kicking the can down the road and ending back right where we are, but with a lot more, whether it's producers who are engaged in a cooperative meat processing plant or other small businesses, then eventually selling out to the larger packers, and we've lost this competition? How does the industry manage that risk and make sure that we're doing what's right for the producers, but also not just perpetuating this cycle of lack of competition?
Well, I personally think if you're adding capacity, even if there's a let's say the big four all of a sudden, you know, doesn't go well and they buy it out, you still actually have that extra capacity. So I talked about earlier how we're maxed out on our capacity slaughter now from Monday through Friday. If you have extra plants, you then can slaughter more cattle Monday through Friday, and that may help you on your labor pool where you don't have to work on your Saturdays. So the increase in capacity is very much needed. I think by adding the plants, that adds competition, and therefore helps producers, and it will shrink that margin, or the producers will get a larger share of the retail dollar compared to what is happening now. So this industry is definitely in need of, in my opinion, some increased competition. For sure, and in several organizations, my own organization has spoken about it at length, as well as, you know, other smart people. So, but yeah, it is going to be just like every marketplace. No matter what what widget they're selling. There's going to be competition. There's going to be some niches that people, the industry needs to figure out. And the industry will do that. It's going to be interesting to see how it goes forward.
So I just think we have to recognize the cattle industry has long legs on the production side, and what's been too many cattle here for a period of time may quickly turn around to be not enough cattle, even with current capacity, if we aren't careful. So we'll see how many cows we've lost out of the West, out of the Northern Plains as a result of the dry weather, and how long those stay out. But it's interesting that we're going to be building capacity in the face of drought in a significant portion of cattle country, not as big as the 2012 drought by any stretch. So all of a sudden we go from not enough capacity to too much capacity, and for me that then becomes a larger industry issue. So producers may like that situation. They may see much tighter packer margins and will have fewer complaints about not getting enough share of the consumer dollar. But then that could lead us further down the road of being back on the other side. I mean, this cattle cycle is a lot different today than we might talk about a historical cattle cycle, but it's not gone. Does weather continue to drive? I mean, if you think about 2014, when we saw record prices for feeder cattle in particular, those came as much from being short of supplies from the 2012 drought as anything else. So does 2012, 2021, are those more typical weather patterns than we've seen? To me, again, this discussion of how do you best coordinate cattle numbers with packer capacity is going to be more of an issue, especially if we want to compete with the other meat products as well. I think we've seen some expansion in smaller processing capacity that could get tough going forward. What are ample supplies of cattle might look a lot different. So for me, those smaller facilities, I think Lisa and niche, I'll go niche market, they got to have a premium for that product if they're going to stay in business longer term. So the idea of marketing is going to become very important to some of these small processors that we've seen come on. And if they're not good marketers, that may be the problem that they face in terms of staying in business long term.
Yeah, good afternoon, gentlemen. Spencer Tace with AgriPulse Communications. Wondering, let's say we're full speed ahead on expanding this processing capacity that we have right now in the beef sector. USDA looking at spending a pot of money that they're trying to determine how to best approach that. We haven't talked too much so far here today about the size of the plants that we might be looking to build or expand. Wondering the fact that when the coronavirus hit, some of these 5,000-6,000 head behemoths, as another livestock economist called them to me, the fact that when those went down, we lost a decent percentage of our production capacity. Does that make even though there's some efficiencies plants like that can offer, does that make you more nervous about building plants like that in the context of a potential another pandemic in 5, 10, 15, 30 years, given the fact that we could take a lot of that capacity offline? And should the industry maybe instead look at 1,000, 1,500, 2,000 head plants that might not be as efficient but would offer a little bit better risk management for the sector?
The plants that I personally don't think you're going to see the 5,000-6,000 head big plants built anymore. I think they're going to be more that I would call moderate size or whatever word you want to use, but the 1,000 to 1,500, those plants that I talked about that they're being discussed as opportunities or potential opportunities being built are that 1,500 roughly a head a day. That size is large enough to be efficient. You can sell a lot of box. A lot of this meat is sold by semi loads, and you can be very efficient with that kind of size. When you start getting your inefficiencies is when you start talking your 50 head, your 100 head, your 200 head day kill plants. Those will struggle more, even more so than somebody that's going to do 5 head a day. So. I don't think we're going to see large, massive 5,000-6,000 head
kill plants anymore.
So I think it's hard to answer that risk management question, Spencer. You know, so I think it was conventional logic that if we would have had plants spread out more, that we would have had less issues with COVID-19 and maybe kept more of those plants operating. I'm not sure we actually know that with certainty, that would have been the way it would have played out. So, and I'll say, when's the next pandemic going to happen? I think we've learned a lot out of COVID-19 already about how to run those plants better than we ever were back in 2020. I keep saying I think we learned an immense amount about risk management that gives us less potential concerns about processing capacity shutdown than we saw in 2020. And I'll say that more broadly for the economy. We learned a heck of a lot that won't shut down the restaurant industry, for example, right? We learned about takeout and carryout like no tomorrow. And those folks learned how to pivot. And so I think there's different risk today than there was when we were in the midst of this in 2020. I agree that, you know, we may not see the big 5,000 and 6,000 head plants coming in, something smaller than that. I'm not certain that's driven as much by trying to do risk mitigation relative to the next pandemic as some other economic factors that make those perhaps better choices size-wise. Trying to find enough labor for 5,000 or 6,000 is a little different than trying to find enough labor for someone that's going to run 1,500 head a day.
Lee, does it have to change necessarily if there is a new facility, how the farmers within a certain radius operate? If everyone calved in the fall, if all the calves were born within a 2 or 3 month time, they'll be ready for harvest within that same 2 or 3 month time. I mean, would that change the dynamics of how some farmers would have to operate just so that the new facility could operate on a year-round basis?
Well, the market already operates on a year-round basis. There's always the market will give premiums to areas where supply may feel tight, and so the producers may, you know, not feed the cow aggressively. They'll feed them more of a roughage diet to stretch some cattle out. That's already happening, and that's going to continue to happen. The market will force or entice putting supply at the right time.
Soil and Crop Incorporated is your number one resource for sustainable nutrition. Growers are faced with difficult challenges, and Soil and Crop Inc. has the experience, fertilizer, and biological portfolio to dramatically increase yield and performance in your troubled orchards and fields. Contact Soil and Crop Incorporated today for a free consultation on how we can help reverse the challenges you face as a conventional or organic grower so you can increase your bottom line and become a better sustainable farmer. Contact us today at 559-564-1236 or visit our website at www.callnrg.com. Soil and Crop, putting nature to work for you.
Soil fumigation is a critical step to ensure that your orchard gets off to a good start. Trichlor is a pre-plant soil fumigant and is the foundation for a successful pest management system. Targeted pathogens include soil-borne disease and nematodes. Fumigation helps to create a healthy soil environment that allows the plant's root system to flourish. For more information about Trichlor or to schedule an application, contact Trical Incorporated at 669-327-5076 or visit www.trical.com.
So during the COVID, I'm Megan Dean with KMZU, sorry about that. But when COVID hit and then JBS got hit with the cybersecurity, everybody freaked out and they called it a monopoly between JBS and National Beef and everything. So now beef producers are wanting to try to get rid of that. And in the state of Missouri, we tried to see that work with Valley Oaks Meat. And it didn't go very well. They shut it down. because it was too close to Kansas City. So do you think that's something that we would ever get away from the major processing plants? And if we do, would we need, do you think we would, there'd be a need for stockyards or and then how's the USDA going to do the inspection for all those plants that are replacing the major meatpacking plants?
Yes, I'll take a stab here to start with. So Valley Oaks is a good example, right? So it's one that was both feeding cattle and processing cattle. It has its own unique history in terms of its success or lack of success, some of which had nothing to do with processing. I would say feeding cattle in a populated area created some issues for them. And certainly had a number of folks who were very opposed to that operation. So the question you ask about monopoly, you know, not monopoly. I'll say the more people we have, more processors we have bidding on cattle, the better price discovery we have. Let's not kid ourselves about that. So let's make sure though that we appropriately talk about price discovery. So for me as the economist, I go, do we get the intersection of supply and demand, and that's the price that we see for cattle? If so, that's adequate price discovery. I don't need thousands of packers buying cattle to ensure price discovery, but when does it become too thin? All right, and that's a very difficult question to answer. I sometimes remind us that in the worst of the pandemic, better price discovery could have led to lower prices, not necessarily higher cattle prices. I know that might not be popular with some folks, but I want to distinguish, did we want higher prices because we thought there was a monopoly, or was it that price discovery wasn't happening correctly? And those are very different issues for us to face. And again, I'll say more competition, better price discovery, hands down. I wish all of our ag markets always had better more competition, so we knew that we were accurately determining the market clearing price. I can give you industries that are thinner than cattle that appear to be finding reasonable prices, but it's a very tough question. So when do we become too thin, I think, is a good question that needs to be addressed. But to some of the smaller operations, so I'll go back to Valley Oaks here for a minute. It's not, again, it was going to be tough because you're talking about not a several hundred head being slaughtered a day in that plant. So it's tough in that size, in my mind, to make a go of it. And yes, they had a lot of other folks that were certainly working against them. Yeah. So it's. It was an opportunity for Missouri to kind of get their toe in the feeding and processing business, and there was some good success story of high quality steaks going into this into Kansas City as a result of that. Yet they had a lot of folks that certainly worked against them, and you know, ultimately now we're talking about killing cows at that plant for the most part.
You know, we're just a few miles, half hour from Tonganoxie, Kansas, just outside of Kansas City on 24. In 2017, they announced that the Tyson was going to build a turkey facility there to, at the time, much fanfare, and then shortly after that, to much freak out for a number of reasons. One, you know, people were wondering about what is that going to do to the value of my home, for example. Do we need a plant here? Also, it was, my goodness, the high school is already bulging at the seam. Do we want to bring that in? And part of it, whether it was said or not, could have been, well, who's going to work there, and do we want them to come here? Does that, are any of those concerns with processing possibilities in the cattle business? Tonganoxie is a lot more suburban than I think the places you're talking about, but do any of those concerns exist?
Well, the reality is that, you know, every agriculture wants these facilities, a lot of them just don't want them in their backyard. And so I know Costco up in Fremont, Nebraska, they fought that. Nobody, you know, they had a lot of issues. And that's a big issue for all these companies that are starting from scratch, is they need to find a place that will accept them. You know, a lot of the work is foreign, which comes with different economic problems, or economic realities, I maybe should say, would be a better choice of words. But it doesn't matter if it's pork, chicken, beef. They've all faced that, and they have to find a place where somebody would accept it.
Well, now water, I would think, would be a, depending on where, like if if it's anywhere near the Ogallala, you know, just how in the world you handle those kind of logistics and operations.
Yeah, water, wastewater, they're all part of it. Again, there's a major barrier to entry with the building facility, and that's been the challenge for the industry, and why you're already substantially, the amounts of money that you need is substantial. And then you start talking about the regulations, and you have to have inspectors inspired, then you have to have labor force, you have to have the community that, wants you to be there. That has been the problem, and a major problem with the industry is that it's just a huge barrier to entry, and that's why you have not seen these facilities just pop up so easily and readily.
Lee Scott, Andy Schwab, Northern Ag Network, Billings, Montana. Appreciate you guys coming out today. Certainly this week we're hearing more push for concerns over BSE coming out of Brazil, and it may be more so to my point of the question, country of origin labeling. Are we going to see this as a hindrance or a help to the producers, and maybe of extending it into the producer's bottom line?
So do you and CA talk about country of origin labeling? I don't know.
What's that?
I was just
yes,
kidding.
Yes, yeah.
So two questions wrapped up there, I'll say. So number one, Brazil and BSE, so for sure we're going to want to pay attention to some of the issues of fresh beef coming in from Brazil into this country. The last thing we want is issues here, and it certainly looks like there's been some lax reporting or slowdown in reporting. To me, that issue is going to work itself out over time. Country of origin labeling, you can find a mixed bag of folks that will give you answers about the pros and cons of cool. So as the economist, I'll remind us that WTO has ruled against us on country of origin labeling. So we have, in my mind, two choices. We can abide by that and not go down the country of origin labeling road, or we can ignore it and pay restitution where we need to along the way, and talk about country of origin labeling. For me, the answer to this question is tough in that, do consumers perceive USA beef only as a premium product they're willing to pay some type of premium for? And if the answer to that is yes, then it's an easy path. I don't think we all know the answer to that question, because we've never really done enough research. I looked long and hard for research that I thought adequately looked at what are consumers willing to pay for a USA origin only beef. And it's hard to find good studies out there that to me are definitive. I see a lot of work that's been done, but nothing conclusive in my mind. So I expect cool could certainly be a discussion in the 2023, 2024 Farm Bill, 2025, whenever we decide we're going to write the next one, from a cattle perspective.
Hi, Ashton Carr. I'm a graduate student at Texas Tech University and a co-host of the Ag News Daily podcast. Earlier this summer, we saw the slowdown of pork processing line speeds, but USDA recently announced they have a trial going with 9 processing plants. They're ramping speeds back up. So just kind of wanted to get your thoughts on that, and maybe see some of the effects that we might see if we do kind of see pork processing plants start to ramp up their line speeds once again.
It's the pork stuff.
So good question, and I'll take it this way. So right now on the pork side, given where hog slaughter's been so far this year, we really frankly haven't needed that little extra capacity on the pork side. We've turned down in terms of slaughter numbers this year. For me, the fact that we've come back to now allow these nine plants to increase speeds again is anticipatory, if you will. We're not going to keep hog numbers, I don't think, at their current levels forever. Maybe we're going to still see 2022 as a year of not growing pork supplies, but I think that day will come where we need the capacity. And just as was alluded to in cattle, it's hard to build a new pork processing plant, just as hard as it is a cattle processing plant. So the more we can run the current plants we have at faster line speeds, the more the capacity we can handle. So I think when we're starting to talk about needing to run 2.6, 2.7 million head of hogs a week, we need that line speed increase if we're going to keep up. Otherwise, we find ourselves in a situation where we have hog prices very low and perhaps pork prices very high. Those margins will widen back out. It's a tough issue, and again, I'm not even addressing, is it safe, to increase those line speeds? I'm just talking about straight, what are the economics of that, and we're going to need as much capacity as we can find the next time we grow the sow herd in this country.
Will Robinson, Brownfield Ag News. So, Scott, we've talked about this in the past, and you alluded to this earlier. But you talked about, just because you have more price discovery doesn't necessarily you're going to get higher prices for cattle. So with all the legislation kind of out there floating around for the cattle market, what's the likelihood that could actually potentially lead to lower prices long term?
You're going to have to stay in that stance during their answer, if you don't mind. That'd be great.
And I've got a 20-minute response, so you better get it. So I'll be general here for a minute. Anytime we have government intervention, oftentimes we find unintended consequences of that government intervention. Maybe not all the time. It's a tough question to decide whether we need the government to step in and do minimum negotiated trade in cattle markets, let's say. I think if we were to come back here a decade from now, we likely find fewer players, not more players. And this becomes more of an issue, not less of an issue. And exactly when do we tip over to it's too thin for good price discovery? I think it's tough for an economist to answer that question. I don't think there's a magic number. Oftentimes I say this is where Department of Justice matters a lot. In terms of making that decision, but legislation, as well-meaning as it may be, often will have consequences that weren't anticipated. I came from a dairy conference early this week, and I reminded folks that the food box program. So we spent $6 billion on the food box program, and part of that had a lot of some cheese in the box, but not other dairy products. And all of a sudden, that created. Uneven help to the dairy industry because those producers that were producing milk destined for cheese saw a big boost. Other producers did not, and they're going to grapple with that. In fact, we see USDA coming back with another program trying to help offset some of the effects that we got from what I will say was the food box program. Again, any kind of negotiation, any kind of legislation on minimum negotiated levels at times could create unanticipated effects, potentially leading to lower prices.
Yeah, I will address this as well. I can tell you from my own experience that the market is substantially different when all players are in the marketplace buying cattle. There's one particular major packer plant major in our area that when they are not in the market, the prices are definitely lower. I think we have gone too little
on the cash trade. NCBA's have, when they're just this week, come out and said that according to their voluntary framework is too little. I don't know necessarily what that number necessarily is, but I do believe it needs to be higher than what it is today, and that's what our organization has pushed for. But there is a strong, strong correlation on my own business when every major packer is in the market purchasing cattle and they're not doing it through via formula, we have a better market.
A couple dollars a time.
Yep.
Makes it, you know,
yep.
It adds up.
Yep. You know, and unfortunately, some of these economic research studies, they don't dictate that or show that when those players are not in the marketplace, how that affects the market. And I think that's where some of the economic policies are. But to Scott's point, yeah, I mean, I do think we need to be careful with unintended consequences, because there is going to be some. But I think we've gotten the cash trade too little.
If the cattleman and woman, if the person selling the animals doesn't get much of a price change, but they do have more control over what they can do, is that a victory in itself, or do you think your members really, or whoever's investing in this, will really want to see whether that's $5 or $3 or?
I guess, can you repeat the question?
I mean, if I get the same price, but I feel like I have more control on how I market my cattle, do you think that's going to be good enough?
It's interesting. You know, they talk about the AMAs being economies of efficiency, and that, and there is, there's definitely some efficiencies, I think, on the packer end, because the packers are getting set up to be efficient because they're getting a product that they want for the consumer. However, I think it's coming at the expense of the producer. When I talk to my colleagues in the South, they'll tell you the AMAs that they do is not to get rid of the good, you know. It's to get rid of the poor quality cattle. It isn't necessarily to get rid of the better quality cattle. And you look at what's going on in the North, where a lot of the more cash negotiators, those cattle are the better quality cattle, and those are the ones getting cash negotiated. So it'd be interesting to see, and there's been no economic studies on this as well, what's one worth in the North versus what's one worth out in the South on an AMA. So, that's why some of these policies has come out, and why some of these inner organizations have pushed forward through it.
Yeah. I have a random question. Do you have a truck driver issue where you are?
I do.
I mean, if they're going to drive a truck to Dodge City and back, however long they got to wait in line, what all goes
with
that?
Particularly this last year, has become a major, major problem. I own a semi myself, and I hate driving it, but I'm forced to drive it just because I literally cannot find truck drivers, all my cattle.
Like the pots, you know, those things. There, I mean, you're not putting corn in something that you're going to haul the cattle in, but the people to actually drive the trucks is the issue.
Yeah, it's the labor, the trucking shortage, and a lot of them have gone over the road. The pay has become that much better for them, and so we've lost some truckers to that.
Do you think that a corn farmer who doesn't have cattle sees potential in this as well? Like, if this could improve, could this improve the price of the elevator? Could this lift my corn price 5 cents a bushel? I mean, is that a possibility, or?
Well, it's a different. Like, I mean, it's a totally different market. You got, I within 30 miles, I probably could get, you know, sell my corn to various co-ops, ethanol plants, livestock guys, pork, chicken, you know. It's a totally different marketplace. I don't think they know. They're looking at seeing just a little bit of bump in price.
Right. Anything else? Yeah, go ahead. Do you have one too? Okay.
Coulter Brown, Northern Ag Network. I was just thinking, you know, with the high retail price we're seeing of beef to the consumer right now, as we look forward to next year, do you think we start to test that demand at all from consumers? Given the cattle supply situation, it seems like prices aren't likely to move lower, at least on the cost side from the packing plant. So do you think we start to test that demand, or does the packer, are they going to be forced to give up margin on both ends?
Yeah. Roast beef at my local IGA was $14.99 a pound a couple of weeks ago, and I I chose something else, but that's just one example. But I still got beef. I just didn't get roast beef at the deli. But yeah, good question. Is there a tipping point, or what will these high retail prices do?
So I think there's two issues to address here, and one is relative prices, right? So, you know, does beef price itself out of the protein market? And I would argue that substitution between beef, pork, and chicken is a heck of a lot less today than it was 15 or 20 years ago. And I say that because if you think about how we consume meat today, all right, not everybody goes to the local IGA and cooks their own beef, right? Mm-hmm. We eat so much away from home. And, you know, I don't go to the new Raising Cane's that just opened in Columbia, Missouri to eat beef, right? So I make the choice about the protein I want by the restaurant I pick, and that restaurant often is going to specialize in one, at most two, of those, you know, major proteins. So I see a lot less substitution that might be that, hey, we cut off beef demand because consumers all of a sudden switch to pork or chicken. For me, the tougher question when I look ahead is just overall income levels and inflation in the other bundle of consumption that we're going to talk about. I don't care if fuel costs, utilities, I mean, you name it, right? Everything's gone up in front of us. And I'll say even further, one thing that worries me, so we've seen an economy that's just been on fire, right? Better than we would have thought, all right? You ask an economist in the throes of COVID-19 what their concern was, and it was recession. And yet we've never really seen it, and in fact, demand's pulling like no tomorrow. If you look at the forecasts for income and consumption expenditures in 2022, there's some interesting dynamics going on as we get less stimulus in the economy of, will consumers have less money in their pockets? And one way they won't is if they start saving less. And so are consumers going to be willing to spend? And thus far, all the data says yes. But if that day of reckoning comes where they decide, I'm going to kind of close in here a little bit, I worry, but it's across all the meats, not just beef. I think we've gotten used to some of these higher prices, and it's hard to find there's a choke point that comes out of. It's a really good question. I say if demand were to go away for beef, I don't want to have that discussion about where cattle prices go. I don't care what packer margins are. It'll be a tough ride for a period of time. Thank God we've had really strong demand for the last few years.
And I'll add to that, part of the reason you're also seeing beef demand phenomenally as well as it is the grocery store chains have been going towards that as a feature to get people into the store. You've seen that switch here over probably 4, 5, 6 years ago, kind of about the time that Amazon actually announced buying of Whole Foods, just shortly before that. But there for a while, there's about a decade where they've kind of went away from not featuring beef, and now has become a staple. And they'll, you know, it may become a loss leader for them, and they're still going to feature that. And if that goes away, that would definitely hurt demand. But I don't see that in the near future.
Any closing thoughts? Anything you really want to get off your chest while you have a microphone?
I was talking to Scott earlier before the panel. The industry is going to change. I do think we're going to be seeing this capacity going on. I think there's better days ahead for producers. Hopefully we start getting some rains in the areas where there are droughts. Because it'll get worse. Things could get potentially worse and out of whack if you don't start to see that. So, but I pray for that. But, yeah, it'll be interesting going forward.
Okay. Scott?
It's just hard not to be bullish cattle right now. I say that when you look at just what supplies to me look like as we get, again, more 2023, I think we're going to be short, and it could be interesting. Just look at Fed cattle futures for the 2022 period right now. We're talking about futures that go up every month, it looks like to me, and you look out there. So I think there's some opportunity for maybe producers to be in a better situation than they've come through of late. But the second point I'll say to all of this discussion, when you think about how economics are going to work, and there are economies of scale at almost every stage of cattle production, I look out my windshield in Missouri and I see a lot more 500 cow operations than I did a decade ago. So I think we're getting bigger at every level. It's different, but that's going to continue to happen if you just let economics run. Those economies of scale will continue to make us become more concentrated over time. And so how does the industry want to grapple with it, with the idea that we're going to continue to concentrate? And the fact we've come through all this discussion about pricing, I don't think it goes away. It may go away here for a period of time because we're going to be short cattle, but there'll be a period of time down the road where we're not short cattle, and we might have the next discussion about are we too concentrated? And I just see us continuing to see concentration happen in this industry.
That's our show for today. From the JCS marketing team, thanks for listening.